First case in our calendar is 95650, James Culch versus Structural Fibers, Inc. Mr. Perotti.
May it please the court, my name is Pat Perotti with the law firm of Warren Bernstein. We represent the plaintiff appellant, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
We're here today on several issues. The issue of the application of the Ohio whistleblower statute to an individual who, unlike Mr. Contreras in the previous cases, were decided, in which Mr. Contreras, according to this court, failed to follow any of the requirements of the statute, failed to give any notice to his employer whatsoever, and instead went directly to an outside agency. The court is here to decide today the question of what happens when an individual follows the specific and express provisions of A1A of the statute, complains to the employer on repeated occasions, the employer indicates very clearly that they are going to do nothing, telling the person, that's your job, just shut up and get back and do your job. And following that, the individual then files a report in writing with OSHA as allowed by Section 8C of the Occupational Safety and Health Act.
I'd like to stop you there because I think we are reading the statute differently. It seems to me that the statute very clearly says that a person in the position of your client has to do two things. One is if he or she wants to make an oral statement complaint to the employer, they can do that, but must also make a written report to the employer. It seems to me the purpose is that the thrust of the statute is to get these kinds of issues worked out between the employer and the employee before someone files something or goes to a public agency. Aren't you reading out of the statute that second requirement?
I don't disagree with you at all, Your Honor. That's exactly what this court said in the first case, is that the employer has to have an opportunity to cure before an individual is allowed to go outside to an outside agency. I brought a copy of the statute, but if the court could actually look at the statute in your materials and would look at the section that we're looking at, the General Assembly put in language which provides that, quote, if the employer does not correct the violation or make a reasonable and good faith effort to correct the violation within 24 hours after oral notification or receipt of the written report, or whichever is earlier, then the employee may file a written report with an outside agency.
And so what you're saying is that this employee did in fact orally advise the employer.
Repeatedly, on three different occasions. Each time the employer notified the employer, the supervisor, the upline supervisor, as well as the plant manager himself, he was told, shut up and get back to work, what any of his concern. Now,
in fact, if the employee, and this is my question, I guess not in fact, but if you read the statute that way, somebody reads into it the requirement that the written report also had to be made, there's no time limit on that because it says earlier, oral or written. You could make a written report yet today.
Yes, sir. That's absolutely right. Reading it the way my opposing counsel
says,
it would make absolutely no sense. And we think it's rather significant that this court in the Fox case just recently, in an opinion written by Justice Swiper, indicated that you have to construe the statute strictly. But in construing it, you have to read the statute in peri materia. You have to read every section, not just one. And when you read the sections together, the guts, or I think the punch of the statute, as this court said, is B. It's not A, it's B. That tells the employer what you can't do and what you can get sued for doing. And it says, you shall not retaliate against someone for filing any written report authorized by this statute. And with due respect to what the court thinks, I can at least let the court know that my opposing counsel on page 37 of the summary judgment brief in the trial court, which is quoted, as you can imagine, at length in my brief, specifically admitted exactly what we're saying. He admitted, and I can quote for you, quote, there are two authorized reports under Division A of the statute, one to the employer in writing and one to an outside agency in writing. And that's exactly what this individual did. Now, there's been a question that the court hasn't raised it, but the other side raised it, and that is, why did the General Assembly use the word shall when it talked about a written report to the company? And that's because if you look at the different versions of the statute as it went through the legislative process, the General Assembly recognized that someone does not have to go to an outside agency. They may, when I'm using the statute words, only since the statute only protects somebody who files a written report, if you complain only internally, you shall file a written report with your supervisor, because otherwise you haven't filed a written report anywhere else and you get no protection. On the other hand, if you go on down the rest of that paragraph and do the alternative remedy that the Ohio General Assembly allowed, and you complain to your employer, whether it's orally or in writing, you give them the time to correct, they refuse to do so, and you then do what you're allowed to do under federal law, that is, as my opposing counsel concedes, a report which is authorized under the statute. And again, the guts of the statute protects the filing of any report authorized and retaliation against the individual for having done so. And I remember last time I was here, we had a discussion about whether the facts in the record were disputed. There's no question that the facts in the record as far as what they did to him after we were disputed. We allege, and there's evidence to show, that after he filed his written report with OSHA, a 15-year employee who had never received a single point before this except for an occasional tardy absence in 1989, suddenly this individual got an avalanche of attack. There's no question, and as a matter of fact, the court, lower courts found that in this summary judgment proceeding, that based on the record, they had to concede that this individual was filed specifically for no other reason than in retaliation for having filed that report.
Do you agree or disagree with the evidence that's been submitted that he was also caught not performing the work, not testing these pumps that he was supposed to pump?
Absolutely not.
Check.
The evidence in the record indicates that if you look at our reply brief, we went through in great detail each of the factual arguments that's being made by the opposing counsel, and we cited this court chapter and verse of the record where those arguments are totally contradicted, not only by my clients, by their own individuals. The record indicates that these, and again, these tanks, just so the court understands, these aren't some kind of massive high-pressure tanks. These are little tanks that they use to filter water, such as you do in pools, for example. The pressure that they test them under isn't pressurized water, it's water right out of the tap, which runs normally if you turn on your tap at 80 pounds per square inch. That is the testing that is done. In this case, this individual who's been there for 15 years did the same testing he's done all along, and that is they visually inspect the tank to see if there's any dry spots or pinholes. If they see any dry cluster marks, which is exactly what the record says, then they put it on the test stand and they tested the high pressure water. The defense said that he violated a company rule requiring every single tank to be tested. We asked them to produce a company rule. They said that there was no such company rule. Cover or deposition, page 176, page 177. No one was ever told of a rule to test every single tank.
Well, the employee that complained about it must have thought there was some standard that he was not following. Is that not correct? He was reported to the employer by an employee who complained about him not doing the work. And
well, they are alleging that this was precipitated by another individual named Fabian who reported and said that Mr. Kulch wasn't doing his work. With due respect, if you read the whole record, Mr. Kulch had worked with these people for a long time, for 15 years, and never had any kind of problems before doing these exact same things, never got reported by another employee.
But that issue never really was dealt with by the trial court, was it? It dismissed a summary judgment on the basis of not following the act itself and never got to his defenses.
What the lower court did was the lower court said that these facts that they are arguing are in dispute, and for the purpose of summary judgment, they will concede all these facts to be true.
Okay, but basically,
law,
if yes. We were to reverse on the basis that we accept your interpretation of the Whistleblower Act, it still would need to go back down to have a lower court determine the factual allegations that he wasn't complying with his job, would it not?
If you're talking about a Rule 56 exercise, it wouldn't, because in a Rule 56 exercise, the trial court does not determine the facts. The trial court simply identifies that there are factual disputes which has already been conceded.
No. I'm saying if we accept that you have an allegation for whistleblowing and it's
yes.
not defeated by
yes.
the fact that your guy can fail to comply, then it goes back down for a de novo hearing on all the issues that have been raised by the defense, does it not?
A trial, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
No question about that.
I'm saying is
resolved on summary judgment.
Do you have the original brief on the merits there?
Yes, I do.
Look at propositional law number 2, right? Page 1. Actually, it's on small I.
I have that.
My question is, where it involves whistleblowing, is it a condition preceding for an employee who feels aggrieved with regard to the workplace problems to comply with the whistleblower statute before he or she has an independent legal claim?
No, it is not. Let me explain very briefly why I believe that's what's going on. Let's assume for the sake of argument that Mr. Coles did not comply with any section of the whistleblower statute. As this court said in Collins versus Vespino, in order to decide whether you have a breathing claim, you basically look at two things. Number one, do you have a public policy on which you can base a decision of common law that firing should be not be allowed for these reasons? Now, this court has already indicated there is such public policy. Now, the interesting thing is two points. Long before Greeley, when the court decided Merz, before you even talked about the idea of public policy, this court specifically indicated in Merz that the common law of Ohio at-will employment is not unlimited. And you specifically cited Section 11C of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Now, the point we're trying to make is that there is, in Contreras, the individual was up before this court based on public policy of whistleblowing on one source only, and that was this statute.
And that's where I want you to go with this, because we know all the other things you're telling us about that. The only question was, do you have to, as a condition preceding, qualify under the whistleblower statute before you have a grievance claim? Your answer to that was no.
No.
Is the answer no because Contreras, you would say, is limited to somebody who's specifically claiming under the whistleblower statute?
Yes, sir, absolutely. In this case, we have an individual who is claiming under multiple sources, including Section 11C of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. This court overruled Tulo and said in Painter, we don't just look at the Ohio statutes. We don't just only look at the Ohio Constitution. We look at the Constitution, state, federal. We look at the statutes, the laws, ordinance, regulations, and the common law. One of the federal statutes that we look at is 11C of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. This court already indicated that in MERS. That is a limitation on the common law. The question to be decided, really, under Collins, and this court in Collins explained to the bench and bar what tests are followed, and that is the test described by Professor Parrott. And that is, once you decide that there is a public policy, you then go on and you decide, where it's multiple source, you decide not whether the remedies under the whistleblower statute are adequate or inadequate. You decide exclusively and solely whether the Ohio General Assembly intended by passing that statute to preempt the formation of the Greeley County Law Claim. And I can answer that in one very quick thought. 406, which is the private whistleblower statute, was modeled identically after House Bill 300, which was passed the year before, which is the public whistleblower statute. The public whistleblower statute contains language that says specifically, this is the sole and exclusive remedy. If the court looks, for example, in my appellate's brief, in the Court of Appeals, and the attachments from the legislative history, the Senate itself specifically indicated in those attachments that language was removed from the private whistleblower statute. The language making it the exclusive remedy and preempting all of the remedies was taken out by the General Assembly specifically.
Okay, now that's all in your brief too.
Yes.
So let's stick with the propositions of law because I want to get the question answered. If we interpret the statute as you do.
Yes, sir.
And if, in addition to that, because I think this is one of the reasons certainly I voted to take this case, because we have the issue of whether or not these are mutually exclusive, the whistleblower statute and Greeley. And we tried to reach that in Haynes, and we tried to reach in Contreras and Quick in either case. Or Trader is the third,
right.
I think. This is the case where we could reach that issue.
Yes.
Which courts all of the state are struggling with.
Yes, sir.
If we reach the issues in 1 and 2, do we ever have to go to 3 and 4 in your brief? We're not here to determine emotional distress in Proposition 4, and if we reverse the summary judgment issue in 3 is answered, isn't it?
Well, I wish, but I don't think so. I think that this court, for example, were to reverse only on Proposition of Law number 1 and 2, and I think the rules direct you to answer each proposition that you have set forth in 3.
No, where's that in the rule?
Maybe it's only in the appellate rules. Maybe I'm thinking of
it. It's not even there anymore. It's in 12A that says you can say they're moot. There is no rule like that here.
My only point, Judge, is I can guarantee you that if you didn't address the emotional distress claim and we went back down, the lower court would say the Supreme Court didn't reverse this judgment, therefore it stands well in the case I'd be stuck. And I think that the reason why it's important for this court not only to decide the language of A1 of this statute, which is, again, Contreras was unusual. Burris is an unusual person. He was a lawyer. I mean, that's not the average Joe Sixpack who works on the assembly line, who doesn't have a pocket computer where he can type out memos to a supervisor, a PC. He's got a pair of overalls and a wrench, and he sees something wrong, he goes over and he says, Jack, that stuff is dripping down and it's acid and it's going to hurt something, and Jack says, shut up, Joe, get back to work. And then he tells the plant manager, and then when they refuse to do anything, he then files with OSHA. That's important to address. Really is important to address, but it's also important to address emotional distress, because the lower courts here made the unusual ruling that in order to prove an emotional distress claim, you have to have a doctor's letter indicating that there is some kind of a serious emotional distress. This court said in cases, you have an outraged court where you either have serious emotional harm or serious physical harm. This individual had a heart attack. I don't know what could be more serious physical harm. Finally,
you've used your time, Mr. Friday.
Thank you.
Mr. Souter.
May it please the court, I'm Gregory Souter from Cleveland, Ohio, with Rest on Anderson, representing the FLE Structural Fibers, which is located in Chardon, Geauga County. Structural Fibers is a unique company in a lot of ways, other than it's a business in Geauga County that does, well, maple syrup. Because it's a business that has a whistleblower-friendly culture and history. And I say this because of a number of things, and one was already alluded to by one of the justices, and that is that Mr. Kulch, a liar and a cheat, a person who was stealing his pay, was turned in by a fellow worker. Secondly, the handbook that is in the record indicates that a lot of the work rules make reference to criminal violations, misdemeanors, and so forth. And third, the handbook, which, by the way, as I must mention, in a non-union setting, was adopted by this employer to incorporate a grievance procedure. Not one, but two.
If I could interject something, because you've made some strong allegations against Mr. Kulch, when was he turned in by the employee in relation to his report to OSHA? Was it before?
He turned in the end of September. His report to OSHA was the beginning of January previous.
Okay.
The discharge took place in the following 2 weeks.
Thank you.
The other element in the whistleblower-friendly culture that I mentioned is the grievance procedure, which has a procedure that, as you might expect, the supervisor and his manager and the client's manager to the company president, which is all done on a written basis. This is effective. Whether it's Joe Sixpack or anybody else in this plant, have used it. Mr. Kulch did. Mr. Kulch got a raise that way. He wouldn't have gotten otherwise. He got a job. He wouldn't have gotten otherwise by using that procedure. There's a second procedure.
Mr. Sir, let me interrupt you.
Yes.
I'd like to hear your interpretation of the statute in response to Mr. Prodding's suggestion that we could read out, or I guess read differently, the word shall file with the supervisor or officer a written report to provide sufficient detail, because the statute's written in such a way that the 24-hour requirement doesn't seem to fit that reading of the statute. You respond to that. I'd like to hear you respond here.
Well, my point to conclude, just my thought to get it out of my head, is that the procedures are there in the statute and in the procedures of the handbook, and they weren't followed. And the procedures in the statute are, and this is the first reading ever by the legislature or any court of Contreras or any of the district courts, that there is any more than one scenario that's protected by the statute, and that is that the employee shall make an oral notification, and subsequently he shall file with the same person a written report. And that triggers the employer's responsibility, a mandatory responsibility under A1B, by the way, to respond. Now, A1B, to answer the question, begins with the words, if an employee makes a report. Obviously, that's the written report. The written report of the prior section. So, in other words, all of this is being done to get the employer's attention, so that the employer can carry out its mandatory responsibility to answer. And why is that? That's because the whole chain of events begins with the awareness of a criminal activity. The employer, before the employee goes public, has to have the opportunity to know there's a criminal activity going on here
let
and
let
to
me
make
take,
a responsible answer.
Let me take you back so I understand what your response is. It seems that what Mr. Prouty, I think, is arguing is that the section of the statute that says the employer does not correct the violation, make a reasonable good faith effort to correct the violation within 24 hours after the oral notification or the receipt of the, report, whichever is earlier. It seems to me that's a short period of time, but the General Assembly said you've got 24 hours to react somehow, employer. If the report isn't, and there's no time limit on when the written report's supposed to be filed. So if the employer doesn't respond within 24 hours of the oral, let's assume there's a requirement that a written report be filed, but there's nothing in statute that says when. So within 24 hours of the oral report to the employer that something's wrong in my work environment, doesn't the statute seem to say that the employee can go to the county prosecutor or some outside agency?
No, the statute, if you want to eviscerate the statute, as Contreras said, you can have it tortured into that, certainly. But that's not what the statute says, nor has anyone ever read it that way. What this statute says is that the employee reports to the same person two ways, so that there's specific identity of who he is and what the problem is, so that a problem can be solved. Now, why is there the 24-hour interview more? Well, in Section 1B, it's not the earlier of, it's the later of, that the employer has got the responsibility to answer. Why are those things there? The reason is because the legislation does not need to have any hair splitting about which came first, the chicken or the egg. It wants both. And it wants both so that the employer can carry out its mandatory obligation to determine if a criminal activity has been going on. And in that way, the policy of the statute is really to obtain voluntary compliance with the law.
So
that's the whole point of it.
Did your client, the supervisor, he reported to two people this problem?
The plaintiff reported to no one. The plaintiff reported to Scrivener Ocean.
So,
was agreement procedure on the advisory council or the safety committee. There were, as we're alluding to,
he made no oral report whatsoever.
No, he made no oral report of any quality. And I add gripes. Is this statute here to protect rumors, gripes, gossip?
So he made a gripe. Did his supervisor say, put it in writing?
He has the opportunity to put it right if it is something.
Did anybody say to him when he complained, wife, whatever you want to call it, you need to, here's the company form, you need to fill it out, or you need to put it in writing in some fashion?
Mr. Justice, the type of right we're talking about is not rise to the level. He's got a duty to determine if there's a criminal violation. He never did that. What we have in the record are things like,
I thought we just said in Fox that you don't have such a duty.
Sorry?
I thought we just said in Fox that that the employee doesn't have to, isn't held to the standard that he has to make an absolute determination whether or not there's a criminal violation.
No. In Fox said he doesn't have to be infallible, but he has to be reasonable.
Okay.
But my point is that if an employee comes along and says, hey, Joe's got a rash, what's an employer to do? Is he supposed to say, this puts me on notice that there's a criminal violation and I, employer, have to make a written response? I mean, my obligation as employer under 1A1B is to make a written response. Now, is an oral right, rumor, gossip, anything other than the combination of both the oral report, oral notification, and written report, is anything less than that going to give me fair notice as an employer?
What are you willing to acknowledge that this gentleman said to someone in the court?
I have no idea. He could have said anything all day, any day about anything. As long as he doesn't bring it to the attention of the company and say, there's a criminal violation here, you got to do something about it. What he did is say, so-and-so's got a rash, somebody left in an ambulance. Well, who called the ambulance? The company called the ambulance. It doesn't have to be told by Mr. Culps that the ambulance was there.
Counsel.
Is this something that the employer has got a one-week responsibility for?
Counsel, are you saying then that the employer has no obligation to inform an employee that anything he observes in the company that may be dangerous, he should put it in writing? They have no obligation to do that? You expect all the employees to know that you have to make an oral and a written report within 24 hours. Is that correct?
We have procedures in our handbooks for safety committee notification. Two biggest procedures.
Trying to answer my question.
And they're there.
My question is simple.
Why are you able to do that?
Counsel, do you want to talk with me or
yes.
What? What do you want to listen? Which?
Oh.
I've noticed that. My question is simple. Does the employer have any obligation to the employee to inform him that if he does has something that is dangerous, that he should put it in writing?
I don't see the source of that obligation. There is one outside of the employee handbook, which is notification.
So then you say it's the employee's obligation to know that by some means that not only does he have to orally complain to the employer, but within 24 hours he must have a written complaint to the employer. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Reason being, because the employer has an obligation to respond in 24 hours.
Why would the statute, with regard to 24 hours, Counselor, why would the statute say oral or written, whichever is earlier? And could he not just write a report up as of today, because the earlier notification would have been oral? The statute does say oral or written, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so why would they put that in the statute?
The reason it's in the statute is because the oral and written notification is supposed to be given to the same person, and the legislature does not want to get in the business of trying to determine which came first, the chicken or the egg.
Well, it doesn't say written, oral and written. It says oral or written.
No, it says oral. It says shall subsequently file a written report.
Yes, the second
sentence is a development of that. The first sentence sets forth the obligation, as Contreras said. It sets forth the dual dictates that must be followed or there's no cause of action. And as I try to keep going back, that's because the employer's got a mirror image obligation in 1B. And it has to be of sufficient quality that the employer be able to know it is on notice that it has to give response. Section about the timing is the development of that. So the legislature has not created a new standard of duty. It's just saying, well, whatever you do, we want to have a response. It's not creating a new element. The elements are already created in the first statute, the dual dictates.
Let me give you an example. An employee goes to an employer and says that tank over there is leaking, the tank has marked on it toxic fumes. Mr. Employer, that tank is leaking. I think it's going to injure me and other employees. I think it could be a violation of OSHA. Goes to the employer and whoever the responsible person is and says that clearly. 26 hours later, the employer has done nothing, has shown no interest in that. Doesn't say anything, but just doesn't do anything. Doesn't the statute seem to suggest, and the employee, by the way, has written out a report of this, but he left it in his workplace and didn't give it to the employer for some reason. At 26 hours passes and the employee is really concerned about these fumes still escaping in the workplace. No response from the employer. And the employee knows what the statute says either through the employer's handbook or the employee just simply knows what the law is, and so he goes to the county prosecutor and says, it's been 26 hours since I advised my employer that this dangerous situation occurred. Does he not fit within the statutory language, the second phrase that we're talking about, the reporting either of the two or either the earliest of the two events. That's the issue that we're concerned with. The statute seems to be inconsistent to me. First part of the statute is very clear. You must do two things, employee. You must orally report, and you must file a written report. That seems to favor this relationship between the employer and employee. Let's work these things out at the workplace. But the second part of the statute seems to say, employee, you can go to the county prosecutor or OSHA 25 hours or 24 hours and 1 second later. Doesn't that what it seems to say? Isn't that what it seems to say?
A couple of answers. First, there are no two parts of the statute. It's all one thing.
Well, but there are words in the statute that we have to apply, and whether you call it two parts or the first sentence or the whatever lines these are, there are words in the statute that we simply have to apply. We're given the statute by the General Assembly. First part seems to be they really got it clear. They really did it more clear than a lot of times a lot of statutes we see. It looks easy until you get to the second, the words that follow the requirements. Then you begin to wonder.
The second part of the answer is that there's nothing to prevent the employee from going to OSHA first before saying anything at all.
Well,
anybody.
Sure.
If he does so,
but he doesn't get
he
the
has the protection of the OWC, but he doesn't have the protection of the statute.
Right.
He has other protections. So the timing of it, in order to fit within this statute, the steps have to be followed. The oral notice to the same person gets the written report with an opportunity to respond. That's the only way that voluntary compliance with the law, the employer's duty to respond, makes any sense. Otherwise, let's take away 1B. There's no reason for the employer to have any obligation. Let's go back to the way the statute was originally drafted in the House bill. We said verbal or written, and the House retreated from that and said, no, verbal isn't so good. We'll just go with written. And then the Senate added something a little different with the oral notice. They didn't change anything. They didn't change anything by doing that. So as I say, he could file with the public anytime he wants, but for this statute's protection, as Contreras says, you must follow the dual dictates. And there's only one set of obligations here, the first sentence. The timing of the other obligation just segues into the employer's response.
You have used your time, Mr. Sitter. That's what the red light means.
I want to have an opportunity to discuss the issue.
No, that's 15, 16 minutes. Mr. Carter, you've gone over your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
A couple of quick issues. Never complained orally to the company. Well, I guess they really did, but it wasn't that good of a complaint. Paragraph 4 of the affidavit, page 151, page 156 of the deposition. Not only did he complain, he indicated that the problems were so serious that he thought people were dying from it because he had seen a fellow co-worker and people had rashes. Bloody nose on the sport floor, and he saw a guy collapse and they had to take him away in an ambulance because he was having reactions to these fumes. That was the kind of complaint he made. And that was the kind of complaint to which the appellants or the employees counsel himself on page 7 of his affidavit for the court of appeals said, and they told you, quote, that's just your job, go do your job. As far as the other issue, Chief Justice, you said that the legislature is addressing a concern. You're absolutely right. The legislature is addressing two concerns in the first part of that statute. They were addressing the concern for the opportunity to cure, and this is talking where you only go to the employer. They were also addressing the concern about having a written record that somebody reported to avoid the super tenure thing that the you see all through the legislative history. They say, what if you say, Mr. Moyer, you're fired? And he says, oh, I filed a report with a whistleblowing situation here yesterday, and you can't fire me. And how can the company prove it? Because there's nothing in writing. That's why they said that only written reports are corrected. That's why in any one of these situations, you've got to have a written report. When you do it only to the company, you have to have a written report, because otherwise you don't get protected, and they also have to have a cure opportunity. When you do it to the company and the agency, they've got to have a cure opportunity, but then the legislature put the language in that they did for specific reasons, and that is, once you tell them this is what it is, they refuse to act within 24 hours, you have a right to go externally, and that is, quote, a written report protected and authorized by the statute. The defendant admits that at page 37 of the own.
You've used your time, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I ask the court to reverse the demand. Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.